Shiva, 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 Shi Good evening to those of you on the East Coast. I'm delighted to welcome you to our third class on the Divine Masculine. And if you were here a few minutes before we started, you heard a very soft, very fluid, beautiful rendition of Om Namah Shivaya by Wa, the great kirtan singer. And if you just joined, and in the last 2 or 3 minutes, you heard the wild version of Shiva Mantra by Bhagwan Das, who does really capture in that kirtan the quality of the yogis Shiva. Shiva Shambho, who's worshipped with drums and horns and yogis wearing matted locks and ashes on their brows, who gather together in the dark of night and literally howl, Jaya Shiva Shambho. This is the Shiva of the yogi renunciants, especially of the holy city of Varanasi, which is one of his seats. So as we begin our third class and as we begin our conversation about the deity who is, as far as I can tell from my reading of historical sources, the oldest deity in Indian lore, reaching back to the archaeological remains of 4,000 and 5,000 years ago in the pre-Aryan city of Mahendradoro, where terracotta images of the yogi god, known as Pashupati, Lord of Beasts, were unearthed in the archaeological sites. And will be discussing Shiva from the multi-levels point of view, that is the only way you can really describe that one who is indescribable. Before we plunge into our mantras and our meditations, I just want to acknowledge how beautiful the level of interaction in the listserv is, and I also recognize that it's overwhelming for some of you. It's especially overwhelming when you think you need to follow all of it, which, of course, we don't. From my own point of view, as a teacher, the convener, the facilitator of this transformative process, I love the way when people share in this very unbridled, open fashion, partly because it gives me the opportunity to really see where everyone is. But for those of you who are doing the class in the midst of your busy lives, please know that it isn't necessary to follow the conversation on the listserv any more than is comfortable for you. So, one thing that I think it's very important to say here is that the deity forms in the Indian pantheon carry the different flavors and facets of both the sacred and the human, because deities are both independent, sui generis manifestations of consciousness, appearances within the independent, self-generating consciousness that is the source of all this. They are also, of course, mediated by human beings. And so one of the things we've come to recognize is that deity images and forms evolve as culture evolves. And one of the ways in which we evolve culture in our time, especially as people steeped in Western culture, is to recognize that we can explore the divine masculine and the divine feminine both as vortexes for worship, as avenues for entering into deep meditation or unmediated experience of the sacred. And we can also look at how our experience of the sacred is mediated by our personal experience. In the case of the divine masculine, by our fathers, our lovers, our teachers, and by patriarchy itself. So for this reason, the way we interact with the divine masculine or the divine feminine will always be dependent on how we see the masculine and the feminine, both in the world around us and in ourselves. Because the spiritual consciousness of the Indian subcontinent is so old, and because India is in reality not one unified culture, but many cultures from many regions and many religious cultures from many peoples at many levels of consciousness. So it's been a fertile nexus in which so many different paths to the divine are seen and understood. So, and in the non-dual traditions, that is the traditions where there is the understanding that whatever exists, exists within a single divine consciousness and is ultimately not different from that, there's also a very inclusive understanding of how to approach deity. So, deity, the form of a deity, is seen as incarnating absolute awareness, that is, as being a particular form, like a holographic form of the absolute consciousness, and also as the incarnation, as it were, of a particular facet or characteristic of the divine. And the way these facets of the divine, of the sacred, are seen is really different in different regions and in different sects and in different traditions. Even the stories can be different. So, for example, in the traditions that honor the absolute under the name of Vishnu, they all tell stories, and their mythology is full of stories that show Vishnu as superior to Shiva, while the traditions that honor Shiva as the absolute will have stories which show Shiva one-upping Vishnu or often awakening Vishnu from some form of delusion. The goddess-loving traditions, the traditions which honor the divine as Shakti, show the goddess as the formless source of all that is and this world as her play, while the Shaiva traditions, the ones that we're going to talk about today, revere Shiva as the source and the goddess as his power, who makes possible the play of manifestation, but who is ultimately a part of Shiva. So it's important to recognize that as we describe and depict the unique qualities and attributes of the divine masculine and the divine feminine, the truth is that they will ultimately point us towards the essential source from which they arise. Deities are literally vortexes of energy. They're concentrated, really catalytic force fields. And we could say that the formless pours itself into these forms just as it pours itself into our forms, our consciousness, our human consciousness. The difference being that the deity forms embody a level of consciousness and power that is far closer to the ultimate source, so that it serves cosmic functions and contains powers and capacities that are not fully developed in us. Although part of the the power of the tradition is that the yogic tradition insists that these capacities can be developed in us, that it is possible for a human being to recognize that deity, any deity and all deities, are not only accessible to us, but actually accessible within our bodies, that we can find deity within our own body. So though these forms have evolved over the years in different genders, with different qualities, with particular mythologies, and though you can describe them and meditate on their forms and their qualities and their attributes, the truth is we only really know them when we deeply meditate on them and tune into them on a wordless level. So as some of you have brief and sometimes prolonged experiences of the deity forms directly in this class, many more of you have experienced their energy as it's working in your day-to-day life, as it brings up aspects of your consciousness that may have been hidden, as it heals parts of you that may have been unhealed, and in the process brings them into awareness. So this is very much a part of the practice of deity consciousness. We never know how the deity is going to interact with us. So many of you, we've been finding, are particularly drawn to one aspect of the divine masculine and not very much drawn to another. And one way to resolve this, to work with this, is to understand that each deity form actually acts as a unique pathway into Supreme Consciousness itself. Some of those pathways draw you, some of them don't fully draw you, but every one of them, whether you end up wanting to immerse yourself in it or not, every one of them has something to reveal to you about yourself as well as about the divine. And, you know, the other thing is that when we recognize the mythic transformations that these deity energies undergo, it can also help us, if we really internalize them, to realize the energetic transformations that we ourselves are able to undergo. So if Krishna can take a form as a woman and embody the deluding power of Maya, if Shiva can appear as a pillar of fire or as a meditating yogi or an erotic lover, it also shows us that we have that fluidity within ourselves, and that the more we approach as these deity forms embody the recognition that every one of us is both in form, embodied, and also free of form, free of body. The more we can recognize that, the more we can understand how genuinely fluid our consciousness is. So this all becomes very clear as we enter the world of Lord Shiva, that form of the divine masculine whose essential function is to facilitate our liberation from delusion. Shiva and his inner fire, his power, his Shakti, is the light that can dissolve the delusion of separation that is constantly tempting us, drawing us into the experience of the truth behind the masks of the world. That's his divine function. His consort goddess Parvati is herself a form of Kali, the form of the divine feminine whose ultimate gift is liberation from forms. And so the two of them, Shiva and Shakti, are both the transcendent source of all that is. I'm a Shaivite, so to me, they are the names I give to that source, which also includes in Shaiva mythological consciousness. It also includes Vishnu. So that form of Vishnu, the protector of the world, asleep on the cosmic ocean, the cosmic ocean is Shiva. So, again, full disclosure, Shiva's been my own Ishta Devata, my chosen deity, for almost 40 years. I most comfortably study and teach from the texts known as Agamas, which are said to have been channeled from Shiva's teachings, from his wisdom. And I want to say also that my intention originally was to make this course all about Shiva, who represents the divine masculine quality of freedom more, let's say, pointedly than any other of the divine masculine forms. But with these courses, there's usually a difference between what I intend to teach and what the Shakti wants to teach. And the curriculum tends to rise out of the wants and needs and karmic predilections of you guys as much as from me. So since we're all part of the divine mind, it would make sense that the divine mind channels itself through every group of practitioners and really inspires pointers into experience that are what is arising at a particular time according to, let's say, the collective need. So, for example, in this time when I think all of us on this day are still reacting to and working with, praying for, trying to understand the events at the Boston Marathon, it's perhaps very appropriate that we are meditating on Shiva, whose cosmic duty is to dissolve forms, to create transitions into the ultimate peace, and into whose divinely benevolent body all confusion, all sorrow, all suffering, all the profound inequalities and difficulties of our present day world can be held and dissolved. So as we chant the mantras invoking the presence of Shiva, let's offer this class and our practice for the healing of the rift in the divine fabric, in the fabric of the universal consciousness that took place in Boston as it takes place in so many parts of the world. And let's allow our dedication and our practice to be offered as a balm, B-A-L-M, as a balm to the pain of the world in times of conflict, in all the places in the world, here and in all those other places where pain and confusion are being inflicted on our fellow beings. Let's offer this practice with the wish that grace may touch every being in every part of this earth whose life is in fear or danger or pain or sorrow or confusion or grief. And you can find yourself a comfortable posture. Let your attention flow into the heart. And we'll chant the mantras invoking the grace of Shiva, that divine consciousness whose real nature is being, awareness, and bliss.
Chitananda-murta Nishprapancha-shantaya Niralambaya-deyate Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Sachitananda-murta Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Deyase Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Sachitananda Murtaya Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Deyase
Yes, that through the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask to know equanimity beyond grasping, hatred, and dullness. And we ask that we and all beings experience true equality, the true equality of all that lives. And with your attention flowing with the breath, begin to tune your attention to the inner channel, the pillar of energy that runs between the perineum and the crown, that runs, truly speaking, from the base of your spine down through the core of the earth and through your crown up to the heavens, up to the center of the solar system. This sacred channel, which flows through the middle of your body, can begin to reveal itself to you as the breath flows in with the sighing thought of hum and flows out with the subtle sigh of so. Allowing the breath to center your awareness in the inner body, not worrying if the channel is straight or if you see it, being content to know that it really is there, and that as the breath flows in and down with the thought, with the mantra hum, and flows out and up with the mantra sa, or so, that this absolute core of consciousness within your human body is being gently activated and opened so that it can, if not in this moment, in subsequent moments, allow you to see what incredible majesty you have living inside your body. in India, Shiva, Vishnu, and the goddess, the three deity forms most often associated with the Absolute, are sometimes brought together in this very wonderful popular phrase. It says, you should invoke Vishnu in public, Shiva in private, and Shakti in secret. You should invoke, worship Vishnu in public, Shiva in private, and Shakti in secret. And there are different ways of interpreting this, but one way of looking at it is that Vishnu is that form of the divine masculine which is equated with worldly life undertaken righteously, undertaken with dharma and skill. He's the deity who brings you all the benefits of living a beautiful, righteous life in society. Shiva is the deity whom you invoke for yoga, for the skills of yoga, the manifold skills of yoga, and the esoteric teachings about reality. And Shakti is the love and power which allows you to follow either of these paths, the householder path or the path of the yogi, who may also, of course, be a householder. So in the Hindu tradition, the very large and multi-layered figure of Shiva is associated on one level with the cosmic power of dissolution. And it's said that when the billions of years of the cosmic lifetime have passed, Shiva takes the form of a deity called Kalagni Rudra, literally the howling fire of time, and incinerates the entire cosmos, which is then enfolded inside the vast cosmic body of Vishnu, the divine dreamer, until it's time for it to be brought forth once again. So in the esoteric tradition, of course, Shiva is the deity who dissolves forms in the mind of a meditator. He's also the guru of yoga. He's the eternal guru whose teachings arise spontaneously in the heart as we sit in meditation. And he's also very kindly provided us with the teachings of yoga. Shiva is the source of what the texts say are the 84,000 forms of asana practice and innumerable meditative practices for coming close to the divine. And of course, in the ultimate sense, Shiva is Satchit Ananda, the underlying awareness which we sang to in our opening mantras, into which all apparent dualities resolve in meditation. Pure beingness made famous by Eckhart Tolle, who is actually a great example of a Shiva-style teacher in the contemporary world, who teaches that all your issues, all your problems, all your confusions will dissolve when you allow yourself to find the space between thoughts, the space between breaths, the space where pure being arises and eradicates all your stories. And in Kashmir Shaivism, Shiva's name is really the name for the primal absolute awareness, the formless absolute transcendent awareness. My guru, whose mantra was a Shiva mantra, used to say when he gave us the mantra, he would accompany it with a little card which said, Shiva is not a Hindu deity. Shiva is pure consciousness. Shiva is the highest truth. So as we speak about the divine masculine in his very specific sakala form, his form with qualities as Shiva, let's keep in mind that his form, his mantras, and also his energetic being are not simply forms, they're also portals into the immense formlessness of consciousness. In the non-dual Shaiva tradition, the tradition taught by Abhinavagupta, who is a great sage of 10th century Kashmir, Abhinavagupta made the point that in ordinary practice, there are three understandings about reality. One is that the divine and the physical world are inextricably apart. This is, of course, the understanding known as duality, where, and actually many of the Vaishnava paths, the worshippers of Vishnu, and some sects who worship Shiva, will tell you that although we can receive grace from the divine, we can even become part of the body of the divine, that the human soul is always separate from the divine because the divine is great and we are small. That's duality. There's also the understanding of complete non-duality, in which the understanding is that nothing on this earth plane is actually real in itself, that what we experience as physical reality is a kind of divine dream, that what all this really is consciousness, which has taken these forms, but which will eventually reveal itself as all one, as an awareness in which you and me and the physical world and our thoughts and our emotions are all simply arising and subsiding. That's non-duality. And there's a space, a state in between called the dual non-dual, in which it's said that forms arise in non-duality and then they become real for a while and then they dissolve. So, you know, the dual non-dualists say that Shiva, Vishnu are both non-dual transpersonal consciousness, and they're also forms. The non-dual Shaivism of Abhinavagupta talks about a state in which everything has dissolved into the non-dual, and we recognize that there is only consciousness, and yet we also recognize at the same time, in utter paradoxical mystery, that the deities, the physical universe, and the subtle universe between the physical worlds and the worlds of total non-dual consciousness, that they are all there simultaneously. So in other words, this universe is simultaneously a complete illusion within the vast cosmic awareness, and it is also completely real. So Shaiva consciousness in its highest and most beautiful form allows you to look forward to this exquisite recognition that the divine is completely and totally available within our form, within the forms of the world, because this world is what's called a theodicy. It's an appearance of the universal consciousness known as Shiva Shakti, as the world. This is my guru used to say, was once asked, do you see God in that tree? Because his teaching was, God lives within you as you. So a reporter once asked him, do you see God in that tree? And my guru said, no, I see God as that tree. So this is the view that recognizes that Shiva is manifesting as us and as all this. So just hold this understanding. The great mantra of hardcore yogis, the hardcore renunciate yogis, is Shivoham, I am Shiva, meaning my awareness is not different from the absolute awareness, the vast ocean of consciousness, Shivoham. And in Tantra, the famous line that describes the essence of the non-dual tantric approach to yoga is worship Shiva by becoming Shiva. In other words, so fully internalize the divine that you really experience no difference between yourself and that. You dissolve into the deity, which could be the deity as the divine masculine or the deity as the divine feminine. But many of the great philosophers, certainly in Kashmir, where, at least in the old days before the troubles began, was so exquisitely beautiful that it was very, very easy to realize that the landscape you were looking at was fully imbued with divine energy. The great Shaivite non-dual philosopher Utpaladeva, who taught that the human awareness is a form of the divine awareness, also wrote ecstatic poetry extolling the life of the devotee. And his Meditations on Shiva, his Shiva Stotravali, is filled with beautiful devotional poetry, which I'm going to read you a couple of verses from that poetry, because it does give us a sense of what it is to hold together the divine masculine as pure consciousness, pure awareness, and the divine masculine as a very specific, subtle being. Homage to Shambhu, resplendent lotus, dwelling unsullied in the midst of the world's thick mire of illusion. Homage to Shambhu, the auspicious one who is ever bound as our souls, yet enjoys eternal liberation, who is beyond both bondage and liberation. May you be glorified, O Deva, who can be worshipped in any manner, in any place, in whatever form at all. May you be glorified, O granter of boons, who are served by those aspiring for liberation and whose boundless depths of beauty dispel all afflictions. May you be glorified, O form of the great mantra, the great cloth representing your absolute oneness is filled with the nectar of freedom and has not a single spot of color. May you be glorified, O Lord, adoration, O protector of the universe, O supreme Lord of the three worlds. For refuge, I come to you. So, again, you can close your eyes. And imagine that you're sitting on the sacred mountain known as Kailas. The mountain of Kailas, at certain seasons of the year, is a beautiful garden of alpine majesty. And there you find yourself in the presence of the meditating yogi known as Shiva, or Shambhu, which means the auspicious one, or Shankara, which means the giver of grace. And you see him seated with his eyes closed. Many of you know his form, and we have some on the website. His body is white like the moon. His neck is encircled by a great cobra. His hair is long, and a portion of it is piled high on his head in that with that matted locked appearance that we know from people who wear dreads. His features are finely chiseled. In his hair is the new moon. And from the new moon drips nectarian essence that in a few minutes you're going to be able to inhale into yourself. His two eyes are closed, but in the middle of his forehead is the vertical third eye, which is wide open. To his side is the trident, the trishul, which represents the three worlds, the three states of consciousness. His body is broad-chested, thin-hipped, very beautiful. Around his waist is a tiger skin. His third eye is looking at you. And as you gaze at Shiva, you experience the soft blessing of his moon-like gaze. As you inhale, the beams of silvery light that flow into you through his third eye. The light of Shiva's consciousness is flowing in through your forehead. And you inhale it as silvery moon-like rays that flow through your brain and begin to flow through your body. And as you inhale the silvery light of Shiva's third eye, as you allow that light to fill you, your awareness may find itself wanting to hold on to the sounds of the mantra. So as you breathe in the light of Shiva, you can breathe it in with the thought of hum. And as you feel that silvery light flowing through your body with the exhalation, you can, if you like, accompany it with the soft thought of so. The mantra which means I am he. Drawing in the blessing and the light of the consciousness of Shiva. Through the white light that flows from his third eye into your own forehead. And as your inhalation takes in the light, your exhalation allows it to flow through your body. And little by little, you feel that Shiva's blessing, Shiva's white light, is filling your body with his essence, which is supreme peace, wisdom, and cool, moon-like, radiant love. And little by little, as the light flows into your body and through your body, see if you can become aware of the presence of the central channel, the pillar of the Sushumna Nadi that rises from the base and flows up to the crown. And be aware of the esoteric significance of this channel, this form inside your body. because the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, is one of the forms within the human body that Shiva's most profound form takes. The Sushumna Nadi that rises from the base of your spine up through the crown of your head, that flows down into the earth and up to the center of the solar system and beyond, is the form of the Shiva Lingam. And though for many of you it may feel like a slender channel or simply a elusive energetic thread, right now, see if you can feel that this channel within you is actually a pillar of white light, fiery white light energy. That it is that sign of Shiva called the Shiva Lingam. And having the feeling that the breath is flowing with the sound so, as it inhales the white light from the third eye of the deity who sits before you on Mount Kailas. At the same time, see if you can feel within you the presence of this subtle pillar of white light energy, white flame, that rises to the center of your body from the crown to the base, from the base to the crown. So you can open your eyes if you like, and you don't have to open them. You can just sit with closed eyes in meditation and listen to the stories of the Lingam. In India, as in Native American spirituality, the land itself is filled with natural, sacred emanations of the divine. So just as many of the old goddess shrines are actually stones or caves, places where ancient peoples felt or even saw the goddess's presence, in the same way, Shiva is seen and worshipped in the land masses of nature. He appears as mountains, Mount Kailas, the mountain that we've been imagining ourselves on, is actually a form of Shiva. Arunachala Mountain in the south, in the state of Tamil Nadu, is also considered the mountain as a form of Shiva. Ramana Maharshi, the great non-dual teacher, actually worshipped that mountain as Shiva. A friend of mine just sent me a picture of a banyan tree in the state of Kerala, which is considered to be a form of Shiva. And these are forms that are upright. They have a thrusting, rising quality to them. They are forms of the lingam. The word lingam actually means sign or significator. And in its natural form, it also has that thrusting, phallic-shaped, upward thrust of the divine masculine as it so often appears in the natural world. So these very early representations of the absolute as the divine masculine often have this thrusting, penetrative, upward-moving quality to them, aspect to them. And we see them in many different cultures. So the story about the Shiva Lingam goes that it first appeared as a huge pillar of fire that seemed to have no beginning and no end. And in this story, Brahma and Vishnu have been arguing about who is the greater deity when this pillar of fire appears that is so infinitely powerful that neither of them can take their eyes off it and neither of them can find where it begins or ends. So they take animal forms to and Brahma takes the form of a swan and flies up to find the top. Vishnu takes the form of the boar and burrows into the earth to find the bottom, and neither can discover where the pillar of fire begins or ends. Brahma, however, couldn't bear to admit defeat. Brahma often comes out looking like sort of an idiot in these stories. So he lies and says that he's found the top of the lingam, and he brings back a flower that he claims to have plucked from the lingam's head. And at this, Shiva's voice thunders from the sky, "Brahma, you lie. There is no top to my being, and there's no bottom." And from that moment on, Brahma was deprived of earthly worship because he had not been able to admit that he couldn't find the beginning or end of the absolute pillar form. And in this story, Brahma represents the mind, which deludes itself into thinking that it can encompass the absolute, and which always, if you know what I mean, wants to feel that it knows everything that's going on. Vishnu represents the heart, which can open itself and surrender to the unknowable mystery. And the story of the fire lingam is one representation of how the absolute is both visible and invisible, knowable and unknowable, a form that appears in the world yet reaches into the infinite as the spaciousness of consciousness. And all over India, there are natural linga, which are known as Jyotirlinga, linga of light, that were not installed by human beings, but arose spontaneously out of the land. And I think you will find, as you become conscious of this, that there are many forms in the natural world that you can find, which you can say are representations of the divine masculine in that pillar form, and your own inner channel, your central channel, is the inner form of the linga. There's also a picture on the website of the ice lingam at Amarnath in northern India, which is a spontaneous lingam made of ice. Debbie told me when I sent her the picture to put up, she says it looks very strange and very cold, and it does. It's a huge silvery ice form, and every year thousands of pilgrims go to visit it. One year there were so many that the lingam began to melt because of the heat of the human bodies. So in the sense that someone actually asked the question whether the meditation that we're doing is specific to the sacred masculine, and in the sense that this central channel is the lingam, this is a sacred masculine meditation. Of course, in the sense that it's a meditation that takes you beyond gender, it's neither masculine nor feminine, and in fact, it's a meditation that we also practice when we're activating the divine feminine in the form of Kundalini. And therefore, the lingam is often seen poised in the cup-like yoni form, which represents the divine feminine, which holds the masculine in its embrace. So this image of the masculine and feminine joined in the lingam yoni is one of the symbols of the union of masculine and feminine. Another is the form called Ardha Narishwar, which is the androgen in which the body of Shiva, the masculine is half the body, and the other half of the body is Parvati, the feminine. And both of these forms, especially the lingam yoni form, contain the symbolic recognition that ultimately, Shiva, the divine masculine, in his or its absolute form as consciousness, is self-reflective awareness. He is pure awareness, knowing itself and experiencing bliss. The ground of everything that arises and yet also the Lord of Yoga, the consort of Parvati, the Guru. And as such, Shiva has many, many names and many, many qualities. The most paradoxical thing about him, and Shiva is a deity of ultimate paradox. He's both gentle and peaceful, as in the form that we were meditating on, where his every breath emanates the deepest peace. He is the ultimate state of meditation, moon-like and silvery in its capacity to irradiate our mind. But he's also the powerful, wrathful deity known as Rudra, whose name means the howler, who the sages of the Vedas, the writers of the Vedas, when they composed the hymn to Rudra, which is called the Rudram, they begin by asking him to put away his arrows and not afflict them with his wrath, but instead to give them boons. So he's called Bhava, which means beingness, Sharva, which means divine archer. He's called Bhairava, which means the fiery or wrathful one. It's another one of his wrathful names. And as we've said, he's called Shankara and Shambho, two names that connote his peaceful auspiciousness, his grace-bestowing quality. He's also called Nilakanta, the blue-throated one, which is a name he got when he drank a deadly poison that threatened to destroy the world. And it's said that he holds the poison in his throat. So Shiva is that form of the divine, this is a very significant thing for us as practitioners. Shiva can hold poison in his throat, contain it so that it doesn't harm us and it doesn't harm him. He's also called Virabhadra, the heroic warrior. And Shiva sits in the groves of Mount Kailas, the world mountain, where he meditates eternally. But he's also a forest deity whose roams the forest and the wild places. In fact, when the Greeks came to India, they associated Shiva with the forest, with their forest deity Dionysius, who represented the antinomian, or the qualities of divinity that operate outside society and give ecstasy, that get you drunk with ecstasy. Shiva also is known to inhabit graveyards and cremation grounds, places which are terrifying, and many, many yogis of the Shaiva traditions have a practice of meditating in cremation grounds. In fact, it's one of the practices that hardcore yogis study in order to get over their fear, the fear that might keep them out of the deeper states of meditation. And one reason, of course, why graveyards and cremation grounds are important to yogis, because they're places where the veil between this world and the next world dissolves. So it's possible to slip through the crack between the worlds and inhabit that spaciousness of consciousness, which is the yogi's goal. Another thing about Shiva that's very, very much a part of his mythology is that his companions are ghosts and goblins and other sort of horrific outside of society creatures. And it's my guru always used to stress the point that Shiva is the deity of yogis and renunciants, but also of thieves, outlaws, and of people whose actions are so unacceptable that they can never be accepted by society. Shiva takes all those who are rejected, as well as kings and great auspicious yogis. One of his names is Ashutosha, which means he who is easily pleased. And it's said that where other deities, Vishnu and even the goddess, are demanding, they want you to be very precise and skillful in your worship, but Shiva doesn't care. He will give you his grace, his help, even with the most minimum forms of practice, even with a few repetitions of his name. One of the characteristics of Shiva, in fact, is that he's a deity who embodies paradox and contradiction. So it's said that he carries the Ganga, the river Ganga, on his head. There's a story about it, but we won't tell it now. Ganga she's a river, but she's also a goddess. And yet he also carries Parvati on the left side of his body. So there are these two feminine deities who are rivals, whom he holds together in his awareness. His snake, the snake he holds around his neck, is the enemy of Parvati's vehicle, who is the peacock. And they too are held in consciousness together. But the central paradox of Shiva's formless form is that he is both the ultimate ascetic and he's also the husband and the divine consort of Parvati. And I want to say a little bit about what this means in terms of our practice. One of the myths of Shiva tells of how at the beginning of the world, when Brahma was manifesting creatures, he manifested all sorts of male creatures who became sages, who were known as his mind-born sons. And then he manifested the first woman, who was named Ushas, or Dawn. And she was so exquisitely beautiful that Brahma fell in love with her. And not having any experience of, let's say, appropriate relationships, he immediately began to pursue her. And as he was, and Ushas was terrified, and she started to run away. And suddenly there was a voice from the heavens, Shiva's thunderous voice, busting Brahma, as he does so often, saying, "Brahma, what are you doing? This girl is your daughter." And at that moment, he burst forth into the world in the form of Rudra, carrying a great bow, and pursued Brahma and brought him under control, saved Ushas. Brahma was terribly embarrassed. And Shiva, the story goes, was so disillusioned with the world that such a thing could happen that he retired into meditation. He became a meditating yogi and completely dissolved all connections with the world until the day came when the gods realized that Shiva could not be allowed to remain so completely indrawn, so they persuaded the goddess, the great Mahadevi Kali Durga, to take form as first the goddess Sati and then the goddess Parvati and allure Shiva out of his meditation, become his consort and bring him into the world so that he could function in the world. This is a beautiful story which I actually tell in one chapter of my book. I'm not going to tell it here. But the core of it is that as Parvati is sitting in front of Shiva in the divine grove, the god of love, who's known as Kama, his name literally means desire, sneaks into the grove and shoots an arrow into Shiva's heart so that he opens his eyes, sees Parvati, is moved with desire himself, and then immediately realizes that some other force has stirred him out of meditation. He opens his third eye and incinerates Kama into ash. And it's said that Kama cannot take a body until Shiva and Parvati are married. But Parvati realizes at this point that Shiva cannot be allured by her beauty, but that she has to fashion herself into a being who can be his equal as a yogi, as a practitioner of austerities. And even though she is the great goddess, she takes herself to a secret grove and begins to do powerful meditative austerities until Shiva is brought to realize that she is indeed his eternal consort and comes to claim her hand in marriage. And from that moment, Shiva and Parvati are cosmic lovers. And though Shiva, in his meditative yogi form, has given forth a series of teachings, some of which, according to tradition, are the Yoga Sutras, revealing how by renouncing the world and turning deep inside in meditation, you can experience absolute consciousness. Once he has married Parvati, the teachings that he reveals are the teachings of the Tantras, in which every act of life can be filled with the recognition of yoga, so that eating, walking, sleeping, sexuality, everything that a human being does, if it's done with the correct consciousness, the correct mantras, the correct inner discipline, becomes a pathway into the divine. So Shiva is both the ascetic, the solitary, removed from the world, and he's also the consummate yogi of the world, and indeed the consummate lover, the faithful but erotically invincible consort of the goddess, who also takes many forms in their erotic play. So, again, close your eyes. Allow yourself, just for a moment, to imagine yourself in the presence of Shiva and Parvati, that mountain where Shiva has sat solitarily is now transformed into a beautiful grove. And you are seated in that grove, experiencing that seated before you are the forms of Shiva and the goddess. And you may imagine them, for the purposes of this meditation, as dancing, undulating forms of subtle light. It's as though a pillar of white light is intertwined with a many-colored rainbow, and as you imagine this pillar of white light and the rainbow surrounding it, like the vines that surround a great tree, and you see the rainbow and the pillar of light dissolving into each other, reforming themselves, and once again you imagine that these two subtle forms of Shiva and the goddess are being drawn into your body with the breath. And that the pillar of white light and the dancing rainbow-like colors that surround it are taking form as your inner channel, the pillar that runs from the base of your spine to the crown of your head. It And with the inhalation, your awareness is filled with the subtle blissfulness of Shiva and Shakti as white and colored light flowing in and down towards the base of your spine, flowing up through the crown of your head. And see if you can sense these two intertwined lovers. As a subtle, blissful energy that wants to grace you . It flows in through your inhalation and flows down towards the base and up towards the crown. As an undulating current of light and color. Shiva and Parvati living inside you, dancing inside your central channel. Are also the source of that intuition which has allowed great meditators and sages to come forth with the teachings of liberation. So in the tradition of Tantra, the teachings are given in the form of dialogues between Shiva and Shakti. Shakti will ask questions, and Shiva will answer them, and those answers become the teachings. Many of the great meditative teachings that we experience, that we follow today, come out of their dialogues. And many of them come out of a particular dialogue that is known as the Vijnana Bhairava, the text of that form of Shiva, the fiery form of Shiva known as Bhairava. And it's a teaching that has been used by both Hindus and Buddhists and is still very much loved and practiced today. And it begins when the goddess asks, Bhairava asks Shiva the great question, the big question. She says, O Lord, I've heard the entire teaching that has arisen from our conversations. In scriptures of ever greater power and truth, but I still don't know what is the true nature of reality. And she begins to name a whole lot of technical terms that are taught in the texts. She asks that whether the Absolute is to be visualized in particular forms, She gives various rituals. She asks if these are the way to the truth. And of course, she's the goddess, so she's only pretending to have these questions for our sake, so that these answers will be revealed. And Shiva replies, "My dear one, you've asked the very greatest question. You've asked about the essence of my teachings. So understand that all the forms of the divine that I've taught in the scriptures aren't the real essence. They're like magical dreams or palaces in the sky that are there to help the meditation of those who are still caught in dualistic thought. They are given to help human beings make progress on the path, the way a mother uses sweets to tempt her children. But the reality, the true form of the Absolute, is that absolutely full state that's beyond time and space, that's free of all thoughts, that's blissful. That is the Absolute." And then he begins to give a series of very simple practices for entering into that teaching. And these practices include things like gazing at a blank wall or at the clear blue sky, or spinning around and around and around until you fall down, or becoming aware of the space between breaths, or looking at the pattern of sun and shadow on the floor of your room, or contemplating the sky as your head, as we did in our last class on the Divine Feminine, or feeling the intensified pain that occurs when a needle pierces your skin, and contemplating that, meditating on that pain. Or focusing on the moment when you fall into the bliss of orgasm. So in the conversation between Shiva and Parvati, literally 108 powerful techniques are offered, each of which can take us into that state of fullness that's beyond all forms. And this practice that we've been doing of breathing in hum and breathing out so, and breathing into the center of the body, into the central channel of the body, is one of those practices that Shiva tells Parvati, that Shiva offers Parvati. And in this last few minutes, I want to give you one more image, because Shiva, as the divine masculine, has several beautiful forms in which he appears, each of which has a profound teaching to give us. So he is that pillar-shaped light that has no beginning and no end. He is the meditating yogi. He is the consort of Parvati, ever immersed in ecstatic erotic union and in a constant conversation that's the source of yogic wisdom. And he's also the cosmic dancer, Nataraja, which literally means Lord of the Dance. And I want to tell you the story of Nataraja, because it is such a beautiful and powerful esoteric story, and we'll end with a meditation that comes from that tale. So the story goes that there's a group of sages who are living in a forest in southern India. And they're practitioners of ritual who have the belief that if you do certain rituals correctly, they're magicians, in short. They're practicing earth magic. And their belief is that if you do the ritual exactly and perfectly, that you can change, you can make, create changes in the web of life. And they've been very successful at it. They're doing one great sacrifice that's meant to change the whole quality of life on Earth. And they're in the midst of the sacrifice, Shiva, who is observing them, recognizes that they've completely forgotten that this universe is actually powered and fully manifested and inhabited by the self of the universe, the divine consciousness, who is the Lord, whose nature is grace, and that without recognizing the absolute freedom of consciousness, their rituals, their magic, will only lead them into delusion and ultimately be destructive to the world. So he decides to reveal to them in a very specific form what the truth is about reality. And he does it by appearing in the forest grove where the sacrifice is taking place in the form of a naked yogi with a giant erection. He's exquisitely beautiful. He's radiant, luminous with divine beauty. And accompanying him is Vishnu in his female form, Vishnu as Mohini, the enchantress. Vishnu is a great female impersonator. And when the two of them come into the grove, the sages are utterly enchanted by Vishnu's Mohini form. And the sages' wives, who are very, very reserved, chaste women, are consumed with desire for Shiva. So, and they leave their place in the sacrificial enclosure, both the sages and their wives, and move like ocean tides towards these two deities, who then run off into the forest so that the sages and their wives are chasing the deities through the forest. And suddenly the sages realize what's happening. They realize that they've been tricked. They've been deluded. Their sacrifice is being disrupted. And so they run to the fire and they begin conjuring magical deadly weapons out of the fire, which they fling at Shiva. So they throw, they bring to life a great snake, a great poisonous snake, and they fling it at him, and Shiva grabs the snake and twists it around his neck, and they bring a tiger forth from the fire, which rushes at Shiva's throat. But he grabs hold of the tiger and slits its skin and turns the skin of that magical tiger into his, wraps it around his waist. And finally, out of the fire comes a hideous dwarf who represents forgetfulness itself, the delusion that keeps us separate from the divine. And the dwarf is fully armed. He hurls himself at Shiva, and Shiva again catches the dwarf in his hands, places him under his feet, and begins to dance on the prostrate form of the dwarf. You see this in the statues of the dancing Shiva. He dances and he dances, and as he dances, the earth begins to tremble and the heavens begin to reel. The stars are literally careening around the heavens with the force of his dance. And in the dance, you see how the sages see how universes are born out of his hands and how his hair is entangled in the stars. And they realize that they are face to face with the cosmic divine, the dancer whose body is this universe of endless change, endless creation, sustenance, and dissolution. And as any sensible person would, they fling themselves at the feet of Shiva and ask for his grace. And in that moment, they're all illumined, they're all enlightened. They're all able to see into the heart of the cosmic dance. And in that form, the form of Nataraja, the dancer, is contained the entire mystery of the nature of this world according to the Shaiva teachings. Because in the form of Nataraja, are the five eternal and great activities of divine consciousness. One is Nataraja's hands hold a drum called a damaru that he spins, and the drum symbolizes creation, which comes out of sound, out of the sound made by the drum. Another hand is raised, palms out, in the gesture that says, have no fear, which is the gesture that symbolizes the protection that sustains the world. The third hand holds the fire, which the sages throw at him at the culmination of their attempts to quell him. The fire, of course, represents dissolution. The fourth hand, and this is one of the great mysteries of this form, is turned with the palm facing in a gesture of concealment that's called Dola Mudra. And this gesture symbolizes the way the divine consciousness conceals itself within the world so that we see it all as dense and impenetrable and ourselves as separate. But the hand is pointing to the upraised dancing foot, which represents grace, the grace that allows us to see through the veils of the world and reveals that we and our bodies and our thoughts and the physical world itself are all forms of the divine dancer. And by the way, around the form of the dancing Shiva, you always see in statues a ring of fire, which represents Shakti, the divine feminine, which is the power behind the dance. And when you look at the statues of Shiva Nataraja, and there's one on the website, you see that his face, amidst his wild movements, is completely calm. He is the witness as well as the dancer. The utterly detached observer, who is also wildly and ecstatically dancing, is all it is. And in this, he is us. He is that consciousness which is manifesting as your life. And if you'll close your eyes and consider your life, your body, and the world, in its nature, as a manifestation of dance. The cells in your body are dancing in an endless, constant state of creation, dissolution, renewal. Cells are born and die moment to moment. Thoughts in your mind arise and subside. Day dances into night. Winter renews itself and becomes spring. Everything living, human beings, cultures, civilizations, the earth itself, is manifested, stays for a while, and dissolves. And in the great Shaivite contemplation of recognizing yourself as the very form of Shiva's dance, allow yourself to close your eyes and look into your own mind. Allow yourself to turn in and see if you can see how thoughts arise in the mind. How a thought emerges. It stays for a little while. And then it dissipates and another thought arises. And stays for a while and dissipates. Just see if you can watch the rise and fall of thoughts. and notice how these thoughts and images that arise in your mind, are so compelling are so alluring, seem so real, that most of the time they completely capture your attention. They conceal the real nature of the self from you. So, just for a moment, consider the great revelatory grace-bestowing idea that the thoughts in your mind, the movement of your breath, the play of cells in your body, that all this, just as it is, is made of particles of the divine. It's a complete manifestation and expression of divine awareness. And just allowing yourself to look into your own mind with that recognition, these thoughts that arise in my mind, the feelings I experience in my body, my physical body itself, my breath, wherever my mind goes, it touches Shiva, the divine consciousness, the supreme awareness. Wherever my mind goes, wherever my attention goes, it goes to Shiva, because there is nothing else inside or outside. There is nothing that is not. Nothing that is apart from this exquisite light of consciousness, who, whether you're aware of it in this moment or not, is always Shiva. So allow yourself to hold this recognition even as you open your eyes, if you want, you'd like to do that, or simply sit in meditation and perhaps allowing yourself to breathe in with hum and out with so, but keeping this recognition that wherever your mind goes is Shiva, knowing that this is the ultimate recognition of what the divine masculine actually happens to be, that ground of awareness that holds and contains our life, our mind, our consciousness, that manifests as us. And that both holds, protects, dissolves, and ultimately reveals to us what we really are. So with that recognition, have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. You'll be receiving a homework assignment. The listserv is open, and I'll be answering questions, of course. I want to send you on your way. with the recognition that whatever is or is not, you in your essence are a divine consciousness, are that vast and unknowable and yet completely present awareness, that your awareness in any moment can reveal itself as the divine awareness that has become all this. So have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week. Namaste. Om Namah Shivaya. Blessings. Love.